From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Saturday with the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump. The FBI says a 20-year-old man shot at the former president from a rooftop during a campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. A bullet pierced the upper part of Trump's right ear. Video shows him ducking to the floor while Secret Service agents created a human shield to try to protect him. Two people in the crowd were injured. One attendee was killed before Secret Service agents killed the shooter. The incident is the latest example of how the polarization in this country has erupted into political violence. According to the Washington Post, a YouGov survey conducted Sunday shows 2 out of 3 respondents say the current political climate makes violence more likely. In that same survey, 8 out of 10 people said that political violence is a real problem. This hour, we discuss the context of political violence and what this most recent moment may mean for the future of our country. Is de-escalation possible? What will it take to bring the temperature down, so to speak? And what lessons can we learn from history and from other countries? Our guest is a researcher and a democratization policy expert based in Sarajevo, who has ties to our area here in Western New York. We welcome her back to Connections this hour as we try to understand more of what we saw this past weekend. Dr. Valerie Perry, a senior associate for the Democratization Policy Council, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan.
I guess I'll just start from the beginning of this past weekend, and I'm curious to know what your first reaction was when you saw this terrible news from Pennsylvania.
Sure. No, I mean, I made the mistake of getting up in the middle of the night because it was really hot and I needed to turn on the fan a bit higher. And I picked up my phone and started seeing what was going on. And of course, had trouble falling asleep after that. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thing that is not surprising, but is certainly shocking. It's in line with, as you mentioned in your intro, the general polarization and escalation that we've seen for some time now. I've been worried that something like this would happen, and I can't help but think that I'm sitting in Sarajevo, which is a city that has a past and a more recent history with political violence. It was interesting speaking with a friend of mine who's from here, who was following some of the conversations about these issues on Reddit, and she sent me a screenshot of one where someone actually mentioned Gavrilo Princip assassinating the Archduke in 1914. So some of these discussions are already happening online and comparisons are being made. And I can only hope that we will learn from the past, but it can sometimes be difficult to be optimistic.
Well, and I want to invite listeners, if you've got thoughts to share, you can email the program connections@wxxi.org. We're going to try to cover a lot of ground, but one important place I think to start, Valerie, is this. I want to make sure I understand your own and what we should consider to be a definition of political violence. And I ask that because as we learn more about the shooter here, I want to caution, there's probably still a lot that we don't know yet that we will learn. I don't want to speculate. I mean, a lot's been made of the fact that he was a registered Republican. I don't know what that means in this context. I don't know just how politically interested this man was. There is already some reporting about, you know, him sort of being, but I want to say this carefully, you know, not very well connected socially at schools and you know, so there's these things kind of fly out there. And I just want to ask if it turns out, that's an if it turns out that this wasn't someone who cared all that much about politics, but basically had succumbed to kind of a nihilist set of ideas and wanted to become, you know, famous for all the wrong reasons. Is that still political violence or is that something different?
I mean, it gets down to intent in terms of whether or not an act is being done for a purely nihilistic random act of violence, or if it's being done in terms of timing and also target because of wanting to either send a political message or try to affect some sort of a political change, whether that would be political change in terms of triggering more violence and contributing and to the escalation going on, or triggering to some sort of a, I mean, you don't want to say that violence can lead to anything positive, But you can sort of see where people who end up using political violence may hope that they can have an impact on history. Maybe they are doing it for personal reasons or wanting to go down in history, or maybe going doing it because they really look around them and feel that there's no other option. It's been really interesting to see reports that it's been difficult to find out much about this young man, particularly since so many people live their lives online. And so I think as that unfolds, that will be quite interesting. But I couldn't help but think, though, that if he was 20 years old, he was born in, let's say, 2004. And you can really sort of see that he's never lived in a society where he didn't turn the TV on and see heated rhetoric. He hasn't lived in a society where you had bipartisan cooperation going on all the time. I mean, I'm not making any excuses, but I was reflecting on the fact that a 20-year-old American, when you look at that two-decade period, it's different than someone who might have been born 50 years ago, for example. And when you look at what leads political violence in other settings, it's quite often youth who look around them and think that there's nothing better, that going through institutional methods doesn't work. And they may decide that this is the only option that they see. And looking at what really makes people go from being completely disenchanted and frustrated to being willing to do this is the big issue. And especially considering that there was a crowd. I mean, it's a tragedy that one person, an innocent spectator, was killed, and that two people ended up in the emergency room for this. And so when doing this, I mean, he also must have considered that there would be other people who he was putting at risk as well. So it's going to be very interesting to see what is uncovered about this young man. But I think the thing that's even more worried is it's hard to imagine anything that might be uncovered other than a direct manifesto,
right,
that's not going to feed into the narratives that began practically minutes after this broke. And that's what the most dangerous thing right now is, how this is going to contribute to these polarized narratives that are taking on a life of their own, both from the bottom up, but also, and most importantly, from the top down. And that's what I think really requires attention.
Let's do this here. We're actually going to take an early break this hour, only one of the hour here, because what we want to do is make sure that we try to get all squared away with our technology. And I'm really grateful for the time that our guest is giving us. Dr. Valerie Perry is back with us, a senior associate for the Democratization Policy Council. I already have an email from a listener saying, you know, if you're looking for clues as to, about the shooter, you know, he donated to Act Blue in 2021 when he was 17. I've read that as well. I am not trying to imply anything about this shooter. I'm trying to be as responsible as I can and say, you know, you can make what you want that he was a registered Republican. I don't think we know much yet, and I think we should be very circumspect about rushing into judgments or conclusions. So, and that's why I asked about political violence. I mean, in a moment when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about whether political violence has any sort of fruitful outcome. I mean, I think obviously the answer is almost certainly no, but we are going to talk about some of that context and history. I'll share more of your feedback as well. Valerie Perry is a senior associate for the Democratization Policy Council, joining us from Europe. She has ties to Western New York and the Rochester Buffalo area here. Let's take that only break, and we're going to come right back with her next. Coming up in our second hour, Americans score poorly on basic civics tests. That's not new, but it's getting worse. We don't know basic facts about our Constitution, about how the government is supposed to function, how to compare it to how it does function. But a new program at SUNY Geneseo allows students to really delve into the ideals of the founding and then compare them to how government is working in their own hometowns. And we'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, talking to Valerie Perry from the Democratization Policy Council, who's joining us to talk about political violence in the context of this assassination attempt over this past weekend of Donald Trump. I have to believe, but I mean, I am the layperson here. I have to believe that political violence does very little to advance causes and probably ends up eroding the cause that of the person who is using that violence, or maybe I'm wrong, Valerie. You want to take us through how we contextualize political violence and how effective it is?
You're right that it's easier and more frequent than not that political violence seeds a spiral of more violence. It creates a dynamic of its own that can really even overtake what may have been the alleged reasons underlying the act in the first place. The direction that it's going to go really does depend on the society and the leadership within that society and what they decide to do, whether or not they decide to really have some soul searching and determine and try to really de-escalate in a meaningful way, not just rhetoric, but to really try to reach across the aisle and have difficult discussions in an open way and to set aside the easy options of trolling and digging in, etc. You can see that in different conflict spots around the world where Northern Ireland comes to mind, for example, where after a terrible bombing in Omagh that killed dozens of innocent people, there was finally a move to really say, okay, we have to have a peace agreement. And it took that kind of terrorist attack to get people talking, to get people saying, we do not want to live in a society like this. We need to do something to stop this. And you can see other examples like this as well. The challenge, though, is whether or not you're going to then get the elite level leadership needed to push a dialogue like that forward. And when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about elected officials, but I'm also thinking about media personalities, religious leaders, and other high-profile community leaders, and whether or not they really come together in a high-profile way publicly, but also behind closed doors in order to really agree on a common front. The more natural outcome would be for increasing polarization and the possibility for more violence. To be honest, I'm glad that we didn't see any copycat or any inspired violence in the past 48 hours. I think that's a good thing. I think that shows that perhaps people recognize the risks, but it's something that you really need to be vigilant about because it's the easier option. And some people would gain, including some elites would gain from that. So it needs to be a social choice. And I'm hoping that the elites in the United States will move towards the right one.
Can you contemplate for just one moment, and I don't even really like to do this, but if that bullet was 2 inches to the right and Donald Trump had died on Saturday, what do you think we'd be seeing right now?
That's an interesting question that I was thinking about as well over the weekend. I mean, I know some people who have honestly said that they think that would have been easier on the country because he doesn't have a successor. He is really a one-of-a-kind politician in many ways. And I think some people like to think that that would have sort of ended this political trauma in a certain way, even though it's likely that it would not. I think that there would have been a lot of protests. I think that we would have seen a lot of Trump's very strong and devoted supporters coming out there. I think that the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis would have been it would have had to have been canceled, but I can imagine that there'd be a lot of bottom-up protests and possibly violence, something along the lines that we've seen in other protests over the years, street protests, etc. We have to sort of look at this in the context of the fact that the United States has a terrible cocktail of a lot of firearms, readiness to use firearms, a certain numbness to the use of violence in society that you wouldn't find in many other countries. And also over the years, we've had a series of acts of political violence. I mean, an attempted assassination on a president or a former president is certainly a different level. But we can't forget, the attack on Steve Scalise, on Gabby Gifford, on the plot against Gretchen Whitmer on January 6th. I mean, this is all recent. And as a cumulative set of indicators, it doesn't come out of nowhere. And so had the outcome been different, it's difficult to imagine that it would have been business as usual. There would have been a real possibility for acts of violence at a lower level, as well as moving up, perhaps. And so in some ways, I mean, you don't want to say I dodged a bullet, but that's exactly what happened here in this case.
Literally. Yeah. Yeah, literally. And, you know, this is a very valuable and important public platform, I understand. And this conversation is not about me. But boy, I just have to, I hope, join the many who believe that no matter where your hopes for the country are, the politics are, you just can't ever hope for violence to solve a problem, because violence is not going to solve a problem. It's going to escalate a problem. We should be horrified. We should be horrified and very, very committed to making sure that this is not the way that we solve problems. And I don't know how what impact this will have going forward. I really don't. You know, there's all kinds of political prognostications. That's not what this hour is about. This hour is about understanding just violence and the stability of society versus the instability and powder keg nature of a society that sees this kind of violence. I mean, we were inches away from a very different story. And so, Dr. Perry, is there, you know, typically, is there a way to sort of de-escalate when you feel like you're on the edge? Or maybe you've seen, maybe we're a little myopic here and you've seen all kinds of violence and, you know, really unstable situations. And maybe to you, the United States isn't quite on the edge as it feels right now. But to a lot of people, it feels that way.
No, I think it is on the edge, precisely because this did not come out of nowhere. And it's building on not only a recent history of political violence, like I've just briefly noted, but also is coming on top of a long period of the decline of trust that people have in their community, in their leadership, in institutions, in the government, which leads to an atomization that can be really nihilistic, to use the word you've just used, but also really opens people up to even more polarizing narratives. And this is what makes the United States such a difficult situation right now. Living in Bosnia and Herzegovina, I often have people say, you know, how can you live in Bosnia and Herzegovina where there isn't there another risk of war? Look at all the problems that are still happening politically over the past 30 years, etc. And I'm not going to deny that there are a ton of political challenges here, but I quite often think that on a number of measures, there's actually some more bases for normal thinking, because people have seen what happens with war and they don't want to see it again. People have seen what happens with propaganda and false narratives. They know what happens when politicians lie constantly to them, and have some more antibodies against that. Not complete, but do have some more antibodies to some of the propaganda than a lot of Americans have. And there's also a different approach to society in terms of the ideologies underlying the way society might be organized. I mean, again, there are a lot of cleavages, but there's an agreement about, for example, thinking that, you know, healthcare is a right, or that education should be cheap or free. That sort of European social democratic thinking is pretty much accepted, even in the Balkans, which has had its share of problems. And when I look at the United States, I worry, because I see both the rise in identity-focused polarization that we're seeing, where people look at the person on the other side of the aisle as an enemy, as opposed to just an intellectual adversary with different policy ideas. But that there's not a shared understanding of the type of society people want to live in. There's a lot less solidarity in terms of whether or not people agree on the role of government in their lives, and everything from, you know, local level services to higher level services. And that makes it even easier to fray. I was thinking this weekend, there was an interesting article about this famous book called Bowling Alone by Putnam, where he talked about the fact that, you know, Americans were spending less and less time together in bowling leagues or in Rotary clubs, etc. And when this book came out some decades ago, it really got people thinking. And unfortunately, it's really only gotten worse in the time since the book first came out. People aren't joining as frequently as they used to. You can look at lots of different reasons for this. That would be a topic for another show. But I have to be honest, I was thinking about this last night when I went to watch the finals of this European Championship soccer match. And there were a couple of viewing places in the city where you could watch outside in a big beer tent with a big screen. And this happens all around Europe. And I couldn't help but reflect on the fact that, you know, that's not very common in the United States. You know, people have their Super Bowl parties. People have their parties, you know, in private homes, you know, private man caves. You know, when was the last time sort of you went out and participated in a community event that wasn't, you know, Black Friday or shopping? And the lack of a sense of shared community experience is very detrimental. That's why I was glad to be back in Rochester for the eclipse. I mean, the weather didn't cooperate, but it was interesting sort of seeing how people wanted to come together and seemed hungry to have a shared experience. And the United States is missing that on many, many levels.
Let me also ask you about some other recent events in the United States that are described as political violence. And again, if you're just joining us, I mean, I'm wrestling myself with how to label what this assassination attempt. I mean, it was certainly an assassination attempt. And I mean, there's no question. It wasn't a false flag. It wasn't anything like that. It was an assassination attempt. But what motivated the shooter is still unclear. And that does matter here because I guess I would put it this way. When you think about the man who shot Ronald Reagan in 1981, he had said that he wanted to impress a Hollywood actress. The man who shot Gabby Giffords in 2011, you know, had significant, not only mental health issues, because I don't want to say, well, he had mental health issues. That doesn't mean that you're going to be more violent. In fact, people with mental health issues are often more often the victim of violence. But it was sort of a deeper, longer story about that person than just simple political violence. But then there's other stories that are clearly political violence. I mean, the man who shot Steve Scalise, Congressman Scalise, was a 66-year-old who was just marinating in social media. He hated Donald Trump. He hated the Republican Party. And he was, I mean, all over social media, and then took a gun out and went to try to kill a Republican leader in Congress. I mean, the man who attacked, who wanted to kill Nancy Pelosi and nearly killed her husband with a hammer, would watch 6 hours a day of right-wing YouTube commentary. And so decided he was going to go kill Nancy Pelosi or kidnap her to get some kind of a ransom, ends up nearly killing her husband. That's clearly political violence. So you have these different events that have these different motivations, but in a society with this many firearms and now being roiled by social media, and then you think about what Dr. Perry just described as this bowling alone scenario where we don't have community, we're not seeing each other in person. We're not gathering as much. Americans aren't going to church as much. We're not going to worship together. We're not going to community events together. We're not part of things as much as we used to be. Then you get this very dark view of the world and you marinate in the social media. Is there any scenario, Valerie, where social media ends up being part of the solution, or do you view it purely as part of the problem?
I have to be honest, I view it purely as part of the problem. I've been extremely frustrated by the inability or the lack of will to see more regulation of social media, whether that's in terms of the access of young people to it, but also the way algorithms are developed. I mean, we should be extremely troubled that Twitter, the X platform, we have no way of knowing what is and is not boosted. And yet immediately there's a platform. And we've already seen as well that Elon Musk is showing more and more that he's got very strong political interests and preferences. So it's hard to see it as a net good in the way that it is today. It's at the moment that social media became less about connecting people and more about generating a profit, the more important it became to basically ensure that the algorithm escalated itself to keep people riled up and keep them logged on. The more important it became that news stories weren't defined so much by the content and the depth of the reporting on the issues, but by whether or not it was clickbait. And so the entire information ecosystem really has been poisoned by these dynamics. And so, I mean, perhaps this could be one positive thing that might come out of this is a real movement to try to change that. But I'm a bit skeptical because a lot of politicians and a lot of business people, it's their bread and butter to make their money in this way. This is, again, where it comes down to people and who they're going to vote for, whether they're going to get out on the street and protest, etc. Because without that, it's really hard to imagine the politicians and the business people doing it themselves.
Listeners, it's 844-295-TALK if you want to weigh in on this conversation. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Or again, you can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. And here's Dallas saying, you know, isn't it that after years of comparing Trump to Hitler, that may inspire people who want to kill him and save society? So I want to work through a little bit of this idea. And I have to say, to whether it's Dallas or others who are raising this point, Donald Trump has said that if we don't elect him, this country is going to hell. He has said that you will not be able to afford a single gallon of gas, that you'll have to give up your car, you'll have to give up your livelihood, that you could lose your family, that everything is on the line in this election, and that if you don't elect him, fundamentally we lose the country. So if you want to argue that the rhetoric about Trump and fascism or Hitler is unfair and leading people to violence, you got to grapple with what Donald Trump tells his own supporters. And I don't want to just one sides or both sides. I just want to be clear-eyed about this. I mean, the rhetoric is extremely hot. But I also think there has to be a way to discuss, is Donald Trump interested in illiberal approaches to leadership? Is his second term likely to be significantly more illiberal than the first? What does that mean? What does that look like? What does that mean for our sort of democratic protections? And you can do that in a way that is substantive. And I think you have to, just because, you're nervous about being direct doesn't mean that you shouldn't be direct, but you also shouldn't go over the top and say that, well, if my team wins, then the world is safe. And if your team wins, we're all going to hell. Like, then, yes, I think we're in a real dangerous place. How do you see all of the rhetoric versus how to have a responsible dialogue during a very important election, Valerie?
No, sure. No, I mean, I would add as well the notion of referring to human beings as scum and vermin and poisoned bloodlines is also demonstrates that that Donald Trump and his supporters are certainly not immune to this explosive rhetoric. And it was one thing that gave me some optimism in the past 2 days has been the fact that, you know, across the board, there's been a condemnation of this, whether that's President Biden's speech and comments on this or Democratic politicians, you know, basically, again, saying that deploring this act. And I do hope that will continue. But I couldn't help but think, though, that comparing the elite response to the assassination attempt on both sides of the aisle to the way things unfolded after January 6th is important, because after January 6th, it didn't take, I mean, there was an immediate shared disgust and condemnation of what happened, but fairly quickly we started to see, you know, people trying to sort of move forward from this, Republicans denying what they saw, efforts to try to paint it as something other than what it was, and I'm hopeful that we will not see similar equivocating from the Democrats. What was really discouraging was to see people coming out so quickly after the attempted assassination, like J.D. Vance and Tim Scott and others, explicitly blaming only Biden, only the Democrats, and not taking any ownership at all for what their party has been doing. And unless that changes, it's difficult to imagine that there's not going to be an escalatory spiral. And that's why there's really a need for leadership from the top down to tamp down the rhetoric and the one-sidism. I think it's very surreal that the Republican convention is happening so quickly after such a momentous incident. But I think the timing is also quite good, because we're going to know very quickly what the rhetoric is coming out of that convention and whether or not there really is a commitment to de-escalate the violent rhetoric, the scapegoating, the trolling, etc. I saw that there's already T-shirts being printed that have the slogan "You Missed" on them. Wouldn't it be fantastic to see Republicans, Democrats, and others all coming together and saying, we don't support the profiteering and the commercialization of an incident that led to the death of an innocent person? That's the type of moral leadership we need to see from both sides. And we're going to see this week whether or not there's any real commitment and discipline on this coming from the Republicans. And it's based on the fact pattern of what we've seen over a number of years, it's difficult to imagine that that's going to happen, but it's not impossible. I wish that we were in a situation where we had people like Mitt Romney or Liz Cheney or some of the other moderates actually sort of pulling on the MAGA side of the party now and saying, guys, this needs to be toned down. We need to work with Biden. We need to work to make sure that this does not escalate. But so many of the moderates have either left or been pushed out of the party that there's fewer and fewer forces really to try to moderate. And this is, again, how radicalization works. And so it's not impossible. And we're going to know a lot more in a couple of days. But the initial responses have not been inspiring, unfortunately.
Well, are you someone, we've got a couple of listeners who said they want to see all the living president and former presidents get together, unified, and say, we will not stand for political violence. We will support civil politics, civil campaigns, and we call on our supporters to do the same. Do you want to see Trump and Biden and Barack Obama, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, do you want to see them do that?
I don't think it would hurt. And I think everybody you just mentioned would be keen to do it. But I have to be honest, I question whether or not Trump would want to stand up there and do it. Because I worry that the way he thinks, the way he acts, would make him feel that that would be a sign of a weakness. If they would do that, I think that could be a useful way to try to say, look, we all care about the country more than we care about these different agendas. What I'd also like to see, though, would be more constructive engagement and de-escalation by the religious communities and religious leaders in the United States. When I look at post-war countries, one of the things that you often see are efforts to sort of bring religious community leaders together, whatever faith they are, to try to, again, rebuild society, build bridges, and minimize the chance for revenge. That happened in Bosnia. That's happened in many post-war places. And I think that that's necessary in the United States. Unfortunately, the extent to which religion in the United States has become part of the political equation in a way that goes beyond policy is very dangerous in terms of removing a possible moral voice, but also, again, focusing issues on identity instead of on policy. I was glad to see that there's a small movement growing online called Christians Against Christian Nationalism. And I think more movements like that are critical. Christian nationalism is antithetical to the United States being a country for all of its citizens. And yet it's really become a core part of the agendas of many in the Republican Party. And I think, again, we're going to find out more this week once we see if they talk about specific policy and if they talk about opportunities to try to build bridges in this way.
Well, let me get some of your feedback on the phones. Tim, first in Rochester. Hello, Tim. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing? A longtime listener.
Good, good, sir. Go ahead.
I just want to talk about the bias. I'm sorry. I have to put it out there. I'll keep it short. Kind of, you'll short me anyways, but I'm listening to this whole thing, and the bias is just, I'm sorry, laughable. I mean, you keep sticking your finger towards the right, and both sides are problematic. And the whole rhetoric is, we shouldn't be so surprised this is happening when they keep trying to paint him as Hitler. I mean, what do you think was going to happen? This isn't a gun problem. This is a societal problem. Go.
Okay, so Tim, I just want to ask you then, if you have a former president who is the only president in the history of the country to refuse a peaceful transition of power, and a president who tried to overturn the results of a fair election and has talked about how he would go further the next time, I understand the idea.
Let's use the courts to fight your political opponents just like the real country. Let's do that instead.
Tim, I'm just asking you a question, man. All I'm asking you is we just saw in 2020 the first time we didn't have a peaceful transition of power. And that I think, should horrify everybody. It doesn't matter your political party.
I'm sorry. The media is terribly biased, and everybody's so frustrated because
I'm just trying to ask you a couple questions.
I believe the opposite of everything the media says. And I'm trying to make you guys understand where the other side is coming from. If you want to understand where Trump supporters are coming from, all you got to do is see the frustration, because the media is laughable.
Tim, I'm listening.
Reporting on this stuff.
Tim, I'm listening. I'm just trying to ask you a question, and I'm trying to genuinely listen. So when we had a president who would not agree to a peaceful transition of power, the first one ever.
I disagree with that concept right there. Stop right there.
Okay, so how do you disagree? On what grounds?
I disagree because the reporting on the January 6th has been laughable. The whole thing was, all you got to do is go and, every time they say Trump says this, all you got to do is do your research to say he didn't say exactly that. And it's laughable.
Tim, okay, hold on. Just let me ask you then. Are you telling me that Donald Trump agreed to hand over power to Joe Biden and said that, hey, I lost, and that's what we do in this country? It started with George Washington. It flows all the way through. We have a peaceful transition of power.
I'll give you a perfect example, and if you fact check it, you'll find I am correct.
Okay.
The minute that Donald Trump disagreed with the election results, that's crazy. You can't say that. But every single leftist from before that said the election results were wrong. He's not the president. So why is it different when he says that?
Let me just say one other thing, and I'll turn it over to Valerie. I don't disagree with you, Tim, that in 2016 there was some overheated response to what was a legitimate election of Donald Trump and a defeat of Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton didn't stand up the next day and say, we didn't lose and we're going to fight this.
Actually, I've seen plenty of evidence. I've seen videos of her say just that.
Tim, the next day, she congratulated Donald Trump on his win. The next day. Right?
Perhaps.
Okay. Valerie Perry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to note that as well. I've heard other people make the same comment, and Hillary did. She put on her purple suit, I think it was.
Yeah, it was. That's right.
And she conceded. She might not have liked it. She might have said later that there were problems.
No doubt she didn't like
it. But she did it, and I think that's important. But what I think, though, I mean, again, this shows is a lot of the issues with media bubbles, media preferences, and media sources. And this is what worries me, because even if we can imagine a scenario where all of the top level Republican and Democratic leadership agree that they are going to stop trolling, stop the violent rhetoric, talk about policies, talk about healthcare and tax rates and inequality and maternal death rates, talk about very boring things. Even if they do that, you have to look at how effective that will be when we look at all of the proxies out there. And the proxies can be everything from various commentators on Reddit, things like Steve Bannon or Alex Jones in InfoWars, different shows on MSNBC, etc., that might skew a little bit too far left. There's that entire additional proxy ecosystem, which can give the elites plausible deniability that they have nothing at all to do with them, when in fact there's been some reporting done showing that there's actually quite close coordination on some of these things, or at least a benefit from it as well. And so that's what I think is the most dangerous thing right now. In terms of as well with media, I struggle with this myself, because when I look at how hard it is to set up an independent media in any country, and especially in a post-war country or a country in transition, it's extremely frustrating to see the extent to which years of claiming that all of the mainstream media is fake news has really become part of a lot of people's beliefs. Do journalists make mistakes? Yes. Is it possible for any journalist to be completely neutral inside their head all the time? No. But I think, though, that there should be an increasing discussion on the difference between reporting and opinion writing, on the difference between having an editor and fact checking and publishing a errors, if errors were made. And that's something that we see in the mainstream press, but we don't see in some of the more infotainment news, let alone some of what we see in some of the highly politicized and highly weaponized political shows out there. Yeah. And having a discussion on all of these, again, I was trying to think, you know, like what lessons have I learned from being in a post-war country or studying them on what needs to be done? And unfortunately, I mean, there are no simple answers because rebuilding trust in institutions takes time. It takes just as much time as it's taken to really destroy them. This would be trust in institutions ranging from your local government, the federal government, to media outlets. And this can only be done from the bottom up with people sort of really having an open conversation about what is working for them and what's not, why they don't have faith in their local assemblies, why it is that they feel they're not listening to them, etc. It also requires a return to civic education and understanding how the system works, understanding how to be a critical thinker when looking at this, recognizing that when you're reading something, it's important to read the words, but then you also want to take a look and sort of think, well, huh, I wonder why they put this story on the first page and not on the 10th page. I wonder why it is that this issue is getting so much attention on local TV news at 6, while all of these other issues are not, and really become critical consumers of information so that people can become really informed and productive citizens. And unfortunately, I think the U.S. has gotten quite lazy on that. I mean, it seems like civics lessons don't, they're not standard. They're not obligatory anymore. And the whole notion that people thought that democracy could ever be considered done, or that democratic process could be sidelined because government is the solution, not the problem, means that people have lost touch with that. And just one last comment before I take it back to you, Evan. What very much worries me is that while we're seeing all of these valid comments and frustrations and concerns that are the natural outpouring of a steady decades-long decline at eroding these institutions, we can already see that this election is shaping up to be the most expensive by far, with money coming from individual billionaires, other dark money sources, etc., which is going to separate the results from the people even more. Billionaires tend to not give so much money unless they want something that's going to help them. Not all the time. Sometimes people will give their own money for a policy that's not going to help them. But generally speaking,
they give in their own interests.
They want to get what they want to get.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the question we need to think about is why should we think that an election that is being bought and sold on both sides, to be honest, is actually going to end up making life better for people, is actually going to lead to less inequality instead of more inequality, and is going to create a basis for some social solidarity that's absolutely required to get out of any possible escalatory spiral of violence and polarization. Yeah.
And I'll say this to Tim, who I hope is still listening, and any others who feel the way he does. You're always welcome to call, and your feedback is welcome, and your criticism of me is welcome. This is your public radio. Let me also say that our first effort today was to bring the Republican Party chair locally, Patrick Riley, to this program. He's been on a number of times. He is a very busy guy. He's been traveling. But our intention is to bring him on as soon as we can. We reached out to a former chair. We've reached out to a number of different local Republican leaders. And we're in the middle of summer. Booking's a little harder in public radio in summer. They are going to be welcome, and I hope they will be here sooner than later. And so we can continue that conversation because, Tim, I am committed, as I've tried to do for more than 10 years, of just creating a platform where people can understand the world better. Even if you agree or disagree, I want you to understand the world better, and I hope at a lower temperature. I hope at the kind of temperature that allows us to at least see each other as people. So if you feel like I'm not fulfilling the duty, I'm sorry, and I am going to try to do my best. I'm not going to please everybody, but I'm not on a team. I don't at all consider myself as on a team. I am worried about what happens in a constitutional republic if we don't have peaceful transitions of power. And this may not make you happy, Tim, because I'm wrong in every prediction I've ever made about politics, but I'd be very surprised if Donald Trump isn't elected this year. And if that is the case, I certainly expect it will be a peaceful transition of power. It better be. So that's where I am. I want to keep listening, though, Tim, and I do appreciate your phone call. Jane has been waiting. Hello, Jane. Go ahead.
Yes, Evan. I've been listening to the radio this morning, but all through this, and this is Monday morning already. And this morning, and it was on WXXI, but it wasn't local. You know, you have a lot of programs, I guess, from your central office. I don't know. But this is where I heard it. And it was a really unuseful thing that was said. And I've heard it over the weekend. And it's that this was the assassination of our president. Now, it was a failed attempted assassination on Trump, but he's not our president. And it was, like I said, failed attempt, not an assassination. It seems to me when you speak in those terms, it makes it even more extreme. Oh, our president has been killed. Did you hear that he's been killed? That sort of thing where people kind of probably like me are in and out of listening to some of the radio. But I heard that on such a credible station, and it wasn't local, that they said that it was the president that was assassinated, not a failed attempt. You know, our former president, if I'm saying this correctly, he's our former president. I do think that adds to the hysteria of it when we're trying to nail down facts on what happened.
Okay.
And I'm being overly wordy to try to get one, you know, just get that through. It's not a criticism. I've heard it over the weekend, that mix up. Nope. Your president, that is your former president there, was the one that was it was attempted. It was not on Joe Biden.
Okay.
But anyway, dear, thank you.
Well, thank you, Jan. Let me just say, when you've earned an office, that honorific is bestowed upon you. So you can say former President Trump or President Trump. You can say former President Obama or President Obama. If you're introducing him at an event, you're saying hello. I don't have an issue with that. There was an assassination attempt of President Trump or former President Trump. Those are both correct, I think. Valerie Perry?
No, I agree. It was an attempted assassination because it is a political figure. And you're exactly correct about the fact that people carry the title. So referring to him as president or former president are equally appropriate. But I mean, I think Jane's right in terms of noting the potential danger that can happen from a lack of precision, whether that's intentional or unintentional. Mm-hmm. Because it's like that game of telephone you play at slumber parties, basically. It might be done once on the radio, but then it can continue spiraling until it's unrecognizable on the other end.
And Valerie, I think at this moment here, you know, I'm thinking of it's wall-to-wall coverage since Saturday, and understandably mm-hmm. so. I don't think cable news is good for anyone's brain long-term either. But I even pulled myself away over the weekend just thinking like, look, when there's new information, I want the information. I don't need hours upon hours of rehash and speculation.
Well, and I think, I mean, that's one of the points I had written down as well of what's necessary to try to move forward. And that's, again, politics has to get boring again. It has to become focused on policy. I was extremely frustrated to sort of see that when I would turn on CNN in the run-up to the presidential debate that they had a countdown clock. The fact that politics is being treated as sport, that everything is breaking news, creates a constant set of crisis. And this is done again because no matter who you are, whether it's mainstream or have a strong left or right wing bent, this is because that's how they make money. But there needs to be a pushback against that. So there needs to be a pushback against advertisers who are supporting that. Because the more that this happens, either the more potential there is that someone could be radicalized, or, and this is equally worrying, the more that people will just tune out and say, I'm not going to follow any of this anymore. I'm not going to follow the news about the reporting all weekend. I'm not going to follow what's going on in my local municipal assembly about that budget discussion. And it's when people tune out that we really see the potential then for radicalization, because then that's the end of citizenship.
Yeah, boy. Hey, Bill in Rochester, I don't have time to take your call. I'd love to talk to you on a different day. We're going to keep talking about this, I promise, and I apologize for that. The hour just got away from us. Valerie Perry, we got about a minute left here. What do you want to leave with listeners as we think about political violence and You know, we're at a fork in the road that I hope we choose a much less lower temperature path here, but I don't feel like anything is guaranteed.
Sure. First of all, if you're on social media, don't forward and share things if you're not 100% certain it's from a valid source and it's true. And don't, because otherwise you're contributing to this information ecosystem. For people like your caller Tim before who are frustrated, I just like to ask people, anybody, you know, what would you have liked Biden to say? And how would you have written a speech for him? And what would you like to hear Trump and his supporters say in Minneapolis this weekend? And then based on what happens, based on what happens this week and unfolds, I'll be curious to hear from you, from your listeners, what they hope to see with the Democratic side of things as this goes, because it takes two to tango. And the Democrats are going to be lucky in the sense that they'll be able to calibrate their approach after having seen what's going on in Minneapolis this week. But they're going to need to do so in a very intentional way.
I want to thank Dr. Valerie Perry for joining us and being very generous with her time on short notice, a senior associate for the Democratization Policy Council. Valerie, I always appreciate it. I do wish the circumstances were different, but we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Thanks, Evan. Great conversation.
That's Valerie Perry. And listeners, thanks for all the feedback. We're going to keep these conversations going, I promise, as hard as they are. Short break. We've got more connections coming up.